First Name Sports starts now.
We're kind of on a first name basis around here.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
Okay, let's get started.
From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
A little bit of breaking news while we're still on the air, although this is not necessarily a bombshell. We'll take any breaking news tidbit we can get, as one of the more notable names in what seems to be a less juicy free agent class has become a free agent in the NBA, as Fred VanVleet from the Toronto Raptors has declined his $22.8 million player option and will be set to become an unrestricted free agent in 2.5 weeks, I guess. Now, July 1st is the new league year in the NBA and the NHL. So it's something, and I think that the reaction I have to this is, first off, VanVleet had been, even before he declined his player option, there were a lot of people that were thinking that he might end up with the Sixers, especially if Harden walks, and they're looking for some backcourt help because of how much he really seems to like Nick Nurse. So that would be an obvious domino to keep an eye on. If James Harden declines that option, hits free agency, and returns to Houston, or Ramona Shelburne reporting that he could end up in Phoenix with the Suns. So we'll see what happens with James Harden, and if that does open the door for Fred VanVleet to end up in Toronto. But from the Raptors' side of the equation, first off, they finally hired a coach, as I believe they were the last team to hire. And they go with Darko Radjakovic, I hope I got that right, over the weekend, Memphis assistant. So VanVleet leaves, and I talked about this when they parted ways with Nick Nurse. It felt like this group of Raptors, even the post Kawhi Leonard team that they had managed to keep together, and they were good in 2020, and they got to the seventh game of Game 7 in the bubble against Boston. They made the first round, gave Philly a competitive series last year. It feels like when they lose in the play-in tournament this year, like they did, that Toronto could be on the precipice of a rebuild. I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the play-in tournament, is that the teams that are in the play-in tournament could be on very opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to future team building. In the case of Los Angeles and in the case of Miami, we saw a couple of teams in the play-in tournament make deep runs. The Lakers got to the Western Conference Finals. The Heat are still playing in the NBA Finals. And then in the case of other teams, you look at Toronto and say, well, I think that core has kind of ran its course there. And you look at Chicago, who beat Toronto in the play-in tournament, and you might say, yeah, it seems like it might be time to break up DeMar DeRozan, Nikola Vucevic, and Zach LaVine. You look at the Spurs, who were in the play-in tournament a year ago. Obviously, we saw what happened with them. They bottomed out, and now they're going to get Victor Wembanyama as a result. So I do think that Toronto, there could be some more dominoes to drop. There could be some more players that move, and this could be the start of that domino effect in Toronto. So Fred VanVleet, of course, maybe he just gets a big deal and ends up back with the Raptors. You never know when these guys decline their player options. It usually is just because they're looking for that long-term security. But he will, at the very least, not be on a one-year player option type of situation there in the six. We mentioned we wanted to get to a little bit of a baseball whip around from the weekend that was. And let's start in the Bronx, where, I don't know, maybe the Yankees could have used John Sterling on the field over the weekend, because they lose 2 of 3 to their arch rivals, the Boston Red Sox. And the Yankees, I think this is important, not just for the short term without Aaron Judge, but remember this for MVP time. Averaging just 3 runs per game since Aaron Judge went on the IL. And we said this last year, that Judge was really carrying their offense at times of the year. And it is just a toe sprain, and his injury has been retroactivated in terms of his IL time to June 4th. So perhaps he doesn't miss a ton more time here, but their offense has gone down the drain without Aaron Judge. And I don't understand why a team like the New York Yankees in that market, with that brand, how they can be so reliant on one player in their order the way it feels like they are with Judge. Because, gosh, even when Judge was in the lineup last year against the Astros, you watch that ALCS, it didn't really look like they had much of a chance. They weren't scoring runs at all. And I know that that was some of the best pitching in baseball that they were facing. But you're the New York Yankees. You're supposed to have, I would think, more than you think about all the teams that, you know, Belmer, you and I grew up with, Derek Jeter, Bernie Williams, Jorge Posada, Alex Rodriguez then goes there, Jason Giambi goes there. It was a murderer's row. Jeter was the face of the team, but you knew that there was another few guys that they could rely on, and it just doesn't seem like that's the case right now with the Yankees, and I didn't feel that way last year either. So they lose 2 out of 3 to the Boston Red Sox. The Sox are now, how about this, 66 games in, 33-33, run differential of 0. So they are smack dab 500, and, you know, we'll see. Obviously, that would be better in the National League than in the American League, where there's more depth. It's harder to just be 500 and talk yourselves into making the playoffs. But there is still about 100 games to play. And, if the Sox can have a good month here before the All-Star break, maybe they can play their way into playoff contention. And so a good step for Boston over the weekend, 2 out of 3 in the Bronx. Elsewhere, it was not good for the baseball team that resides in Queens. The Mets were not home. They were in the Steel City in Pittsburgh. But their June swoon continues as the Mets have lost 2 of 3 to the Pittsburgh Pirates. They are now 2-8 in the month of June. And Andrew McCutchen for Pittsburgh recorded his 2000th hit. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but gosh, he's been a rock-solid outfielder for most of his career. And, of course, I think it's really cool, and this is why I love seeing the guys that play their whole career with one team. I got a bunch of old baseball jerseys, and sometimes when I decide which the next retro jersey is, I get somebody that played for his entire career with one team, like Tony Gwynn. I have his Padres jersey. Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub, I have his. McCutchen hasn't done that with the Pirates. He bounced around a little bit in between, but you see the reaction in Pittsburgh, both when he had his first at bat back there this year, and then yesterday when he got his 2000th hit. Really cool stuff, and I think the fans realize how important he was to bringing baseball back in a meaningful way in Pittsburgh, because for the 30 years, or 20 years, I should say, in between Barry Bonds and Andrew McCutchen, I believe the 2013 National League MVP it was, the Pirates were a dumpster fire. And he was a huge part of them getting back. And, you know, Gerrit Cole, obviously, they drafted number one overall. He was good with them as well. But that relationship between Andrew McCutchen and the city of Pittsburgh is pretty cool. I saw McCutchen play with the Phillies in Pittsburgh in 2021, and I felt the same thing. He was getting cheers. At that point, he was like 4 or 5 years removed from playing for the Pirates, and he was still getting cheered when he would come up. So I like that kind of stuff. The Buccos maintain first place in the National League Central. By the way, speaking of the National League Central, the Brewers get swept by the A's over the weekend. The A's have won 5 in a row. They're red hot.
Yeah, I heard some people saying that, you know, ever since the news came out that their move to Vegas might be denied, all of a sudden they're fighting back for the people. I mean, we'll see what
wouldn't
happens.
Wouldn't that be quite the 11th hour twist?
Yes, it would.
There's some, to Belmer's point, I think there's been some reporting that if they can't get the stadium deal done in Vegas, John Fisher, the owner, might sell the team. And hey, on the field, they're actually playing better. And the record for most losses in a modern era season is the New York Mets in 1962 with 120. The A's were on pace to crush that, and now they're on a 121 loss pace. So we could have some drama at the bottom of the baseball standings in August and September. I mentioned the Mets. Elsewhere in the National League East, the Phillies look like they are turning things around as they win 2 of 3 over the Los Angeles Dodgers over the weekend. Also in the NL East, you know, we talked about Luis Arraez last week, but one of the magical first half stories in Major League Baseball has been these Miami Marlins. I went into the season thinking the National League East was the best division in baseball because I thought that, yeah, obviously Atlanta was kind of a rock-solid, always contending type club, and the Phillies had just been in the World Series. The Mets won 101 games last year, and I thought the Marlins, relative to other fourth-place teams, were a lot better. So I thought Marlins maybe could be a 500 team, but gosh, they are second place, and they're really, it seems like, for the fans they do have – they put on a nice little fun ride here, 37-29. Everything's going right in Miami sports, but the Panthers and Heat still playing in their respective finals. Boca Raton, not that far from Miami. That's where the Florida Atlantic campus is. They went to the Final Four. The Miami Hurricanes went to the Final Four. The Marlins, with their 20th comeback victory of the season yesterday, winning 6-5 against the Chicago White Sox with a 3-run ninth inning. And they improved to 17-5 in one-run games, which has been another staple for the Marlins' success. They have a minus 20 run differential, but they are 8 games over .500 because they are winning all those close games, and that continued over the weekend on the south side of Chicago. Gunnar Henderson, this kid's finally starting to put it together for the Orioles. He was a heavy favorite to win the American League Rookie of the Year. Looks like it'll be Josh Young with the Rangers or Masataka Yoshida with the Boston Red Sox, but Henderson, a 462-foot dinger yesterday, propelling the Orioles to a sweep of the Kansas City Royals. Baltimore only 4 behind Tampa in the loss column in the AL East, and they are 5 clear in the loss column of the Yankees after the Yankees lose 2 of 3 to Boston. So the Orioles, we talk about feel-good stories with the Marlins. The Orioles, I think everybody's going to get behind them, given that I think it's easy to get behind that kind of like underdog type team in the division with the big boys like the Red Sox and the Yankees. And the Orioles have all those homegrown kids that are up, and they're obviously playing really well. Not to be outdone, though, Gunnar Henderson. How about this? The longest walk-off home run in the StatCast era, Nolan Jones of Colorado, hits a 472-foot dinger as the Rockies win 5-4 against the San Diego Padres. And that was a highlight of what was otherwise a not great series for the Padres. We will take a timeout and we'll come back. Saquon Barkley speaks at a football camp in North Jersey yesterday as the Giants star addresses where things are headed in terms of contract negotiations with Big Blue. That's next. First Name Sports, Sports Map Radio.
You're back with First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.
Live from the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, as one of the more intriguing plot lines of the NFL's training camp headlines will be, and that involves Saquon Barkley. I mean, this is going to be, I think we have been down this road before with star running backs, but I think Barkley is, can we say cut from a different cloth? I mean, is you think about some of the running backs that have seemingly every big name back. When they get to the end of their rookie deal, this happens. But I think Barkley's better than Dalvin Cook, who got paid by the Vikings, and then, as we saw recently, just got released. I don't know that I can. I mean, is he better than Derrick Henry? Belmer healthy, Barkley?
No, but he's right behind him.
Okay, so Barkley got paid. Derrick Henry got paid, and there was no holdout there. Christian McCaffrey ended up getting paid by the Panthers.
Yeah, he's not as good as McCaffrey.
Not as good as CMC, but similar in terms of his ability to catch the ball out of the backfield and both, unfortunately, a lot of injuries. There have been some, like, he's probably better than Joe Mixon, right? He ended up getting paid by the Bengals.
He's definitely on par with the best, for sure.
Exactly. So, we hear about, like, guys like, then there's that next tier of, you know, guys like Josh Jacobs, who says, like, he wants to reset the market for running backs. Or, you know, Melvin Gordon had a holdout with the Chargers. And when it happens with some of those guys, you know, Ezekiel Elliott held out, won, and then torpedoed, and the Cowboys obviously regret that. And so when it happens with some of these guys, you can kind of see, okay, dude, like, you're not bad, but you're digging in and you're fighting a losing battle here. Barkley is and will continue to be the offensive centerpiece for the Giants because they haven't really gone out and added that marquee wide receiver in the offseason. They drafted Jalin Hyatt in the second round out of Tennessee. He might become a nice player for them. But even though they paid Daniel Jones, it does not appear, at least, as if their scheme and what they want to do offensively is going to deviate that far away from Saquon Barkley. So maybe that's where it's similar to Christian McCaffrey in the sense of when you played the Panthers, if you were an opposing defensive coordinator, you knew everything was going through McCaffrey. And that's also why when we look at some of these other contracts that were given out, Dalvin Cook at the time got paid before Justin Jefferson was there, but Stephon Diggs was still there in Minnesota. You look at Joe Mixon, obviously he became less of a part of the Bengals offense when they brought Ja'Marr Chase in via the draft, and T. Higgins got drafted in 2020. Mixon got his contract in 2020. So, I don't know, you look at the way some of these offenses have, of course, Burrow got there. That's going to obviously change things immensely. So you look at some of these running back contracts that we have seen, and in time, the personnel on the offense with the high-paid running back has evolved enough to where the running back's argument of, hey, I'm the centerpiece of your offense, it worked when he got paid and then didn't end up being the case throughout the length of the big contract, you know. And I think for Barkley, that's what he should be saying right now. Your offense is entirely dependent on my production. So if there was ever a running back that deserved to dig in and say, I'm not showing up to mandatory training camp, he's already not at the mini camp, it would be him. And here's what he had to say about, you know, what might happen now in the next 5 weeks before we hit the deadline for long-term deals with franchise tag players.
The team has said they're prepared to carry you on the tag, on that number, the $10 million number. Would you play on the tag?
You got to July 17th, right? So I guess I will make those decisions or start thinking about that when July 17th comes.
I mean, that doesn't sound like somebody that's on the precipice of a big deal. And so I think that he knows. I mean, just look at the Giants were one of the big talking points in the offseason because they had these two massive decisions to make with their quarterback, Daniel Jones, and the running back, Saquon Barkley. And they got the deal done with Daniel Jones right before the tag deadline for Barkley. And then they slapped the franchise tag on Barkley and said, hey, now we got 4 months to kick this thing down the road. Well, we're nearing the end of that 4 month window as, again, we got about a month until that July 17th deadline comes. And I just think that I would be prepared for Barkley to hold out. I think that, again, if lesser running backs do this and lesser running backs ended up getting paid off their rookie deal like Dalvin Cook, like Joe Mixon, you know, it doesn't – and listen, like, I'm not even necessarily saying Minnesota and Cincinnati and when they gave those contracts out to those guys – I didn't necessarily think, oh, they're going to regret that. I just think in due time, I understand why the Vikings moved off of Dalvin Cook now, because Justin Jefferson is now the best wide receiver in football. They just drafted Jordan Addison in the first round. Like, they're not as reliant on Dalvin Cook being the center of their offense. But that's what Saquon Barkley is right now for the Giants, and he might be second, third best back in the league. So I look at these things very case by case. What are you bringing to the team, and how do you feel you're being valued by the team? And in the case of some of these guys, like when we hear Josh Jacobs talk about it, I'm like, yeah, all right, like you're a nice back, Jacobs, but if you're in tune with the way things have gone for running backs when they negotiate their second contract, I don't know that you're that much different than these other ones that have tried to hold out. And so understand you're playing a, you know, dicey game here if you're Josh Jacobs. Like, I don't think Josh Jacobs has the leverage Saquon Barkley has. Barkley had a healthy year last year, and he killed it. Okay? He had over 1,600 all-purpose yards for the Giants. Missed one game. So if there was ever a time for him to say, I need to get paid, this is it. And you know, I don't think he should cave here, because what happens if you do play the year on the tag? Then, well, maybe, you know, this was the second most healthy year that he's had behind his rookie year, when he played every game when it was still a 16-game season. So we know about the injury history with him. If he has another injury, that's not going to help him. Even if he has another healthy year, then the Giants will just say, well, now you got two straight healthy years behind you. I don't know that that can keep going. So it's kind of a lose-lose in terms of if you play the year on the tag and then you try and negotiate this thing, run it back a year later.
Kind of feels like being a running back in the NFL is a lose-lose regardless, you know, in the end.
And I don't know how we, you know, because there's too many Leonard Fournette, Todd Gurley, like quickly, like fall apart situations. And that's why I get why Minnesota cuts Dalvin Cook. You know, my answer is, and this is why I argued a lot on my 4-hour Zoom calls with my friends about the Eagles and Bijan Robinson, because everybody had Bijan Robinson going to the Eagles at number 10. It's not worth the investment because you're eventually going to be in this spot where, hey, the player looks pretty good. But then the player is going to say, I look pretty good and it's time for me to get paid. But then I'm going to look at you and say, yeah, but the history of your position says I'm going to pay you for past production. You're not going to age as well, and so I'm not going to give you the money. So the way to avoid that is to not have yourself be in one of these situations with your running backs. If you don't draft the running back in the top 10 overall, then they don't have that leverage on you where they could say, hey, you spent a premium pick on me. And if you bring in another back like I'll give Minnesota credit, even though they paid Cook, they can move off of Cook now because Alexander Mattison, when Cook hasn't been on the field, has been pretty productive for them. So they at least feel like they can turn the page and not lose a beat. So if you bring in reinforcements drafted in the third or fourth round, you know, and they learn how to pass block or whatever you want them to learn in their first 2 years in the league or whatever, then they can start to become better players for you. So it's just a basic, like, and I know that this wasn't Joe Shane that drafted Saquon second overall in 2018. That was Dave Gettleman. And you got to play with the cards that you're dealt when you take inherit a roster as a GM or a coach. But, I mean, how many more examples do we need to see of the high investment at running back not working out? Because this is an example of under which you could say, hey, Saquon lived up to all the hype coming out of Penn State. He's been awesome. And we're still doing this where we're like, but should we pay him? I don't know. Maybe just, again, don't draft a guy in the first round to begin with. That's a generalization when it comes to building rosters that we hear a lot in the NFL that I tend to agree with. We'll take a time out. Some tennis history yesterday in Paris. We'll discuss that. First Name Sports on a Monday afternoon, SportsNet Radio.
You're listening to First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network. Live from the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, well, you might accuse me of caring about too many sports, but I'd rather be accused of caring about too many sports than not caring about enough sports. And yesterday, I woke up probably about 8:30, and they were in the middle of the first set in Paris at the French Open final between Norway's Casper Ruud and Serbia's Novak Djokovic. And it was a very competitive first set. Ruud, by the way, if you don't know the name, is the number 4 ranked player on the ATP Tour. ATP stands for Association of Tennis Professionals. And Ruud had gotten out to a quick 3-love lead. Love is zero in tennis, by the way. And he wins the first 3 games of the match. Djokovic finds a way to get back in the set. The set ends up going to a tiebreak. Djokovic wins the tiebreak 7-1 and takes the first set in a set that Ruud probably should have won. And then Djokovic gets out early in the second set, ends up winning a less competitive set 6-3. Third set was pretty competitive. Djokovic makes more plays at the end of the third set and wins the set 7-5, takes the match in straight 7-6, 6-3, 7-5, and is your 2023 Roland Garros champion. And it is the third time he has won the French Open. And he now becomes the first man to win each Grand Slam at least three times. And it is his 23rd Grand Slam title, which puts him in the lead ahead of Rafael Nadal's 22 and Roger Federer's 20. And I think it puts him in the lead for good. If you have not been, if you don't follow tennis as closely, Rafa Nadal has barely played at all in 2023. He just underwent a hip surgery recently. He's going to be out for probably the rest of the season. And the plan is for him to come back and have a farewell tour in 2024 as Rafa is 30. He just turned 37 earlier in June. And, you know, next season seems to be his send-off season. And the interesting thing about this is Novak Djokovic is only 36, but is a young 36 to an old 37 for Nadal. And I thought Andy Roddick phrased it well on Twitter yesterday after the match. He says, tough to make any numbers-based argument against Djokovic being the best. If you're making an argument against, it's likely based on feelings and not record. Congrats on 23. Crazy to even think that's possible. And I think his point about the argument based on feelings and not record is something that we should all try not to do, because we want to be able to argue about the facts and about the numbers. And Roddick, in another tweet, I thought phrased this well as well. He said, as athletes, we are largely judged by numbers. Certainly the clearest, easiest measurement. And so this is no different than, and I hate the LeBron Jordan debate because it's the same, it's like Republicans and Democrats, it's the same argument over and over again. But, and nobody gives, like, it doesn't matter if this was 5 years ago, if it's right now, it'll be the same thing 5 years from now. It's always the same things about LeBron and Jordan. And the thing that the Jordan people always say is, well, he's got six rings and LeBron has four. Well, Djokovic has the most Grand Slam titles and appears to will end his career with the most Grand Slam titles. So as much as that might be oversimplifying it, I do think that that's a hard thing to look past. And then when you look at that other aspect of it, that he's won each Grand Slam at least three times, he's the only player to ever do that. Because if you don't pay close enough attention to tennis, there's hard courts, which are played on the Australian Open and the U.S. Open. The French Open is played on clay, and Wimbledon is played on grass. And so, depending on the surface, the ball moves differently on the surfaces. Clay is the slowest surface. That has always been Rafael Nadal's favorite surface. That's what a lot of the Spanish players grew up on. It's a slower ball, and if you're a warrior-type player like Nadal who outlasts his opponent, plays a lot of long points, you thrive on clay usually. Grass is the polar opposite. It's very fast, and if you're like Federer was always very smooth around the grass because he found ways to shorten points and you know, move into the net well, and he was always excellent at Wimbledon, and Nadal was always excellent at the French. And hard courts kind of vary depending on the complexion of which the hard court is composed. Some of them are faster hard courts. Others are slower hard courts. Well, Novak Djokovic is proving that he is an all-court player by winning all of the majors at least three times. And Nadal, it's what's so amazing about Nadal is he blocked out the French Open. He's only lost three times in his entire career in a match that started and ended at the French Open. Two of those losses are to Djokovic. And so my point is, Nadal essentially blocked out that major from anybody, including Federer, who only won it once, to win multiple times in their careers. And here's Djokovic with three French Open titles, and two of them, you know, he beat Nadal in 2021, and, you know, 2016, Nadal wasn't there, but that was right when Nadal was obviously in his prime. And in 2015, he beat Nadal as well at Roland Garros. So Djokovic is his game translates the most surface to surface. He has the most Grand Slams. So as much as I am a Rafael Nadal fan and he is my favorite, it's just a lot harder for me to, like, Roddick's point is right. Like, you just look at the resume and say, yeah, like, if you're arguing for Nadal, if you're arguing for Federer, it's more based on feelings and emotion, and that's not how you're supposed to argue. Because the best thing about sports is we have games between the lines that are decided, and that's why I don't like the LeBron Jordan thing, because we don't even look at the stuff that happened, like the games and the results. It's just whose accomplishments are better, even though, I mean, I think it's clearly Jordan, but I don't like to diminish LeBron's accomplishments either. And so, therefore, the two sides just bicker back and forth, and nothing ever changes. And I think the whole point of watching sports over and over again is to the results, the games are played between the lines, and as we have more information available to us, our opinions change based on the accomplishments that the different athletes achieve, and then it changes the history of the sport. And that's what Djokovic is doing right now. And so that's why I have for a while felt that Nadal was the greatest. But watching how well Djokovic has aged, he's 36 now, okay? And again, a young 36. Tom Brady was in his player box yesterday in Paris, and people have made the comparison if Djokovic can be a Brady-like kind of career in tennis, in the sense that Brady won his last Super Bowl at 43. Like, you look at this guy at a young 36, and I'll go back to his opponent yesterday, Casper Ruud from Norway, number 4 player in the world, okay? 24 years old, so a young guy, spry, on the up, has played Djokovic 5 times in his career. And obviously, with a 12-year gap, that means all of those matches, Djokovic was at least in his mid-30s, and Ruud has not won a set off Djokovic in 5 matches. So he's just dominating the number 4 player in the world at 36. Carlos Alcaraz from Spain appears to be the one guy of this next generation. Not that there are, Ruud's a nice player. He'll probably win a Grand Slam or two. He's been to 3 finals recently now. Carlos Alcaraz does seem like the one guy that people are saying, wow, this guy could really make a run at the 3 that we talk about as all-time greats, Nadal, Federer, and Djokovic. Now, Alcaraz had some injury problems, it looked like, in the semifinal against Djokovic on Friday, but Djokovic beat him in 4 sets, and the last 2 sets were 6-1, 6-1. And Alcaraz is younger than Casper Ruud. Alcaraz is 20. And Djokovic ran right through him in the semifinal. So, who's slowing this guy down? That's my point. At 36, he is still chugging. And I think the Brady comparison is fair game to think that this guy could keep going. And now, unfortunately, if you're a Federer person, if you're a Rafa person, the conversation is shifting from who is the greatest to how many is Djokovic going to win. And again, these guys are good players. Ruud, Alcaraz, Alexander Zverev, a German, is back on the tour. Like, there's all these guys who have enough talent. Daniil Medvedev from Russia beat Djokovic in the 2021 U.S. Open final. But he just keeps coming back seemingly better than he was before. He's going to be the number 1 player in the world again now after winning again yesterday in Paris. So I don't see how he isn't. I think it's done. I don't like saying that because Nadal is my personal favorite. But Andy Roddick's right. If you make an argument for one of those other two, it's more feelings-based and not numbers, resume, accomplishments-based. Djokovic is the best ever. And he appears to be aging a lot better than Rafa Nadal. And who knows how much longer he's going to keep going. Some disappointing sports media news that I want to get to as we wrap things up on a Monday afternoon. That's coming up on the other side. First in sports, Sports Map Radio.
This is First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Greg Frank.
All right, as we get out of Dodge for a Monday, I saw this and wanted to talk about it because I do think it's a disappointing piece of news involving sports media, and that is that The Athletic, which is owned by the New York Times, is cutting 4% of its newsroom. There have been a lot of layoffs nationwide with The Athletic, and the big clip from like the pull quote that I've seen a lot of people tweeting, which is really unfortunate in my opinion, from the article from the New York Times, is that they are, quote, they are shifting away from having one beat reporter per sports team to broader coverage, which, of course, if you do that, you don't need as many reporters, and hence the cuts come. And I think that, to its core, the most valuable people of sports media outlets are the daily beat reporters. Because you think about columnists, let's say, at a paper. I mean, they're not that much different than us in terms of, like, craft an opinion, take a stance, and boom. But they don't have to be at every game, okay? And so a lot of times, you know, a columnist might have a take and they, you know, write it the same way we verbalize our takes here on the radio. So that's why I think you do see a lot of columnists end up in radio. But the beat reporters that are there every day, and I understand the pandemic probably changed a lot of this in terms of how the sports are covered, and maybe some outlets felt that you didn't have to have a beat reporter at every game. But obviously, we're well removed from that. I mean, it's June of 2023 now, so this seems to be strictly an editorial decision on behalf of the New York Times and The Athletic. And I just think that when you are there all the time, you're going to pick up on certain little nooks and crannies and little minute details that might become something bigger. Like, for example, I brought this up, actually. I nominated it for our 10th inning segment on Friday. The beat writer for the—I don't know if he was a part of the cuts or not, but Matt Gelb is the Phillies beat writer for The Athletic. And he unearthed a story about how there are the most pitch clock violations at Citizens Bank Park relative to other ballparks across the country, and it's actually a pretty sizable gap. And I'm not saying that a non-beat reporter couldn't do that, but in his preamble to his story, in his tweet that teased the story, he talked about how both visiting players and Phillies players have commented on the fact that there are more pitch clock violations at Citizens Bank Park. And so that's something that accumulates over time, where maybe one night you hear Bryce Harper say it, and then the next night they're playing the Mets, you hear Pete Alonso say it, or whatever. And then after four or five of those, the light bulb goes off and that beat reporter said, oh, maybe this is worth looking into. But the only reason that light bulb goes off is because the beat reporter is there all the time. And the seeds are planted. I'll take it a step further. How many times do you hear about a coach or a player maybe that cultivates a good working relationship with a beat reporter? And then, you know, sometimes in the hallways of a ballpark or a stadium, after a media availability, they just kind of are shooting the breeze. And then the coach or player in confidence and in closely quartered areas with just that one beat reporter decides, yeah, I'm going to, you know, I'll let you in on this little secret here. Like, that's not happening to Joe Schmo that's at two games a month, if that. So I think that there's a relationship between the teams and the beat reporters that only the beat reporters locally really feel in this industry. And I respect the roll up the sleeves, wherewithal, and like go to every game, travel around the country. I'll be honest, when I knew I wanted to work in sports, and I really, once I got to college, fell in love with radio, especially. But I didn't think I had it in me to be a beat reporter because I didn't want to live that life, traveling around the country all the time. And, you know, because I would like to travel more, but they're not traveling to have fun. Like, they're traveling for work. And So I think that it is all part of the job. And when you successfully carry out the job, you have some little stories that fall into your lap as a result of your good work. Whether it be that coach that pulls you aside after a press conference and it's just the two of you shooting the breeze, or whether it be something that you pick up on, you say, oh, that looks a little different tonight. What's up with that? And maybe sometimes there isn't a story there. Maybe there is. But you only pick up on that stuff by being there every night. So I believe in this beat reporter coverage, and I think it's a little unfortunate when I saw this because, gosh, for a while, The Athletic, it felt like they had somebody covering every team in North American team sports. And when I saw this, I just thought that I believe is a change for the worse. And I don't think it's the same being on Zoom calls asking to, gosh, how many times do people still, after the pandemic, forget how to mute themselves, or like they don't know how to use the microphone on the Zoom, to the Zoom conference? So anyway, I wanted to touch on that because I do think it's some disappointing news that came from the weekend. This segment has been brought to you by Total Wine & More. With so many bottles to choose from, it's easy to find all of your favorites at the lowest prices at Total Wine. Total Wine has been the best for over 30 years. Find what you love and love what you find at Total Wine & More. Drink responsibly. Be 21. As we wrap up, again, we opened the show with it. We'll end the show with it. The NBA Finals, Tyler Hero. The big news is that he's going to try and give it a go tonight in Game 5. And, hey, if for nothing else, it will add a wrinkle, we hope, at least, to this series, that maybe if he has his best stuff, if he has his A game, Miami could extend this thing. And that's what I talked about in the beginning of the show. If you told me one Miami team was going to come back, I think it's more likely the Heat than the Panthers, who I like haven't even seemed to win the lower scoring kind of game script that would be better suited for them against Vegas, losing 3-2 on Friday night, or excuse me, on Saturday night in Game 4, and then having a 2-2 lead in, or 2-2 tie after two periods in Game 1, balloon out of control into a 5-2 loss. When they lose those two games, you know, you figured there was going to be a Game 2 like there was, or one game like Game 2 where Vegas just boat raced them. I think Miami Heat in basketball, on the other hand, can at least hang their heads on the fact that they went in there, they were the first team to beat Denver in the playoffs on the road in Game 2. And in a close game, their fourth quarter point differential, which has been so good in the playoffs, will carry them to a gutsy win tonight. That's not a call. If you made me pick the game, I'd probably take Denver. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm less certain of the outcome than I think a lot of people are, who probably think that this thing is signed, sealed, and delivered, and you can schedule the parade in the Mile High City. You know, a lot of people say it's cliche, but the last one can be the hardest one to get. And maybe for the first time all playoffs, Denver feels a little tight. Maybe the pressure of winning their first NBA championship in franchise history at home in front of their fans, perhaps some of that could creep into how the Nuggets operate and play tonight. If you made me pick the game, I'd probably take Denver. I do know that in the NBA playoffs, usually from a gambling standpoint, if you like the favorite, you can go ahead and lay the points. And if you like the dog, you should bet the dog to win the game outright on the money line. This might be one of those that I think might be an exception. It's a 9-point spread. I don't think I'd feel comfortable giving up 9 points to back Denver tonight, but I'm not sold that Miami wins the game. So if you gave me the 9 points and I took it with Miami, that would probably be how I would bet this point spread. My bet tonight, though, I took the Heat in the first quarter plus 3 points. Because, again, that goes back to my point of I don't think they lay down. I think they come out with some pride in the first quarter and at least show that we're going to put up a fight tonight, whether that's a fight that gets us back to Miami still in the series or a fight that takes us into the offseason. That I'm not sure of. But I think we're going to get a good game tonight. I feel somewhat optimistic there. So, having said that, watch what happens, and at least we get another game tonight, and I hope we get a game 6 on Thursday. Thanks to John Belmore for producing our show. That is just about going to wrap things up for me here on a Monday afternoon. Sports Kings is up on the other side with Mean Gene. My name is Greg Frank, bidding you all a friendly farewell. Enjoy the NBA Finals tonight. We'll talk to you tomorrow. First Name Sports on the Sports Map Radio Network.